My proximity sensors blared and my shields... A shot hit me, causing my shield to crackle, then go out. Warning lights lit up all over my control panel. I continued straight up, rotating my acclivity ring so it pointed down behind my ship. I just had to gain enough height. An explosion flashed behind me. The shockwave rocked my unshielded Poco. I breathed a quiet prayer to whichever gunner was manning those AA guns when, in another enormous blast, a second Krell ship vanished from my proximity sensors. The last Krell ship broke off, diving out of range. I leaned back against my seat, sweating, head pounding, lights flashing on my console. Alive. I was alive. Pearl, FM said over the line. What are you doing?
I'm fine, Pearl said with a grunt. I'm going to get this one. The shields are almost down.
I quickly rotated my ship, tipping to see the battlefield alive with action beneath. Kimmelin, I was pretty sure it was her, had flown upward after me to get out of range. The rest of the battle was a mess of Krell ships and destructor fire. There. I spotted Hurl chasing an enemy while being tailed by a swarm of three Krell. I'd been forced to leave her without a wingmate. I ignored my blinking shield light, no time to reignite, and dove back down toward the battlefield. I unleashed destructor fire toward Hurl's tails, but I was too far away, and my shots were way off. The enemy didn't break from their chase. Hurl took a hit. And another. Hurl, pull up, I said.
I've almost got him. We're never going to break any records by being cowards.
She fired, scoring the shields of the Krell in front of her. I hit Overburn, tearing after them. But dives were dangerous on the body, and as soon as my grav caps cut, I felt the G-forces in my eyes, forcing the blood up into my head. I gritted my teeth, vision going red as I reached the group of Krell. I hit my IMP by touch. It couldn't take down my shield after all. It was already gone. I didn't see how many of them I caught. I was too close to doing myself permanent harm. I leveled out, my head pounding, my eyes aching. As my vision returned, I started my shield reignition and craned my head, trying to search for Hurl. Was she safe?
I'm taking heavy fire, Arturo said. I need help. Reinforcements are here, Jorgen said.
Everything was chaos. I could barely comprehend the mess, though for the moment, remarkably, nobody seemed to be targeting me. An explosion flashed off to my right.
Got him,
Hurl said. There. Hurl had shot down her target. But two Krell ships were still tailing her.
Pull up, Hurl, I said. You've still got tails. Get up into the range of the AA guns.
She turned upward, listening, finally. Two ships chased her. I ignited my shield, then turned after her, trying to help. But I'd lost a lot of ground.
Shields down, Hurl said with a grunt.
Quirk, I said, desperate, flying, too far away toward my friend. Pick them off. I IMP'd that group. Their shields are down too. Fire.
Ah.
Kimmelin sounded rattled.
I...
You can do it, Quirk. Just like in The Sims. Come on. A flash of light from a charged destructor sliced the air above us, firing toward the ship's tailing Hurl. And missed. Hurl took a hit a second later, and her wing exploded, scattering pieces. The blue glow underneath her ship started to flash. The light flickering. No. Hurl's ship plummeted. From a distance, she was like any other piece of debris.
Hurl! I screamed. Eject! Get out!
Her voice was soft. I could barely hear it through the warnings going off on her dash and mine.
I can control it. I can steer.
Your acclivity ring is damaged, I said. You're losing altitude. Eject!
Not, coward, she said. Brave to the...
A flash of light. A small explosion on the ground. Insignificant in the storm of destruction that was the battlefield.
Pull out, Jorgen said. Everyone, pull out now. Leave this fight to the full pilots. We have orders to retreat.
Hurl. I couldn't move at first. I just stared at where she'd hit the ground.
Spin,
Jorgen said. When had he flown in beside me?
We have to go, We're too exhausted for this fight. Can you hear me?
Blinking back tears, I whispered. Yes. I fell into position behind him as we dove and skimmed the surface to escape the battlefield. We pulled up next to FM and Arturo, and I gasped. Arturo's ship was blackened all along its left wing and side, its canopy cracked. His acclivity ring was still on, so he could stay in the air, but... Scud. He'd survived a destructor hit after his shield had been knocked out. When he called in, his voice was subdued, rattled. He seemed to know how lucky he was to have survived. Hurl, though. Kimmelin finally came sweeping down to join us.
Hurl?
FM asked. She went down, Kimmelin said. I was watching. I tried, but... She wouldn't eject, I said softly. She refused.
Let's get back,
Jorgen said. Another flight of reinforcements arrived at the battlefield. As I watched them, any confidence I'd had in my abilities evaporated. Those fighters worked far more efficiently than we had, banking and flying as teams, coordinating in sharp motions. I suddenly felt I'd need hundreds more hours of practice before I was ready, if I would ever be ready. I wiped away tears as Jorgen's voice, soft but firm, ordered us to accelerate to Mag 3. As we flew, my hands shook, revealing me for the coward I was. Chapter 33. I woke up in a room. A room? Not M-Bot's cockpit? I sat up, my muscles aching, my head pounding. I was inside, in a bed. What had happened? Had I fallen asleep somewhere on DDF grounds? The Admiral would... You're in the infirmary, I remembered. After the battle. Cobb sent you here to be checked over. They ordered you to sleep and undergo observation. I vaguely remembered objecting. But the nurse had forced me into a hospital gown, then had ordered me into bed in a small empty room. I'd been too numb to object. I didn't even remember lying down. It was all a haze. I did distinctly remember the flash as Hurl's ship impacted the ground. I lay back against a too soft pillow, squeezing my eyes shut. Hurl was gone. Eventually, I forced myself out of bed. I found my things on a stool, my jumpsuit, laundered, sitting with my Lightline bracelet on top of it. My pack rested on the floor beside it, and the radio at the side was blinking. Scud. What if someone had answered that? Would M-Bot have been able to keep quiet? My secret suddenly seemed insignificant. In the face of what was happening, the horror of our flight slowly being consumed one by one. Who cared? Who cared if they found out my secrets? Hurl was dead. I checked the clock. 05:45. I found the restroom, where I cleansed. I went back to my little room and dressed, then walked out to the hospital's front desk. A nurse looked me over, then handed me a red ticket. Medical leave for loss recovery. Orders 1 week. It was imprinted with my name, stamped and signed. I can't, I said. The Admiral will kick me out of... Your entire flight has been given mandatory medical leave, the woman said. On orders from Dr. Thayor, head of medical. You won't be kicked out of anything, cadet. You need a rest. I stared at the ticket. Go home, the woman said. Spend a week with your family and recover. Stars above, they push you cadets too hard. I stood there for a moment before I turned and walked out, dully meandering toward the training building. I took the roundabout way, past our POCOs, four in a line. Arturo's ship was off to the side in a little maintenance hangar, with pieces scattered along the ground. Go home. Where? To live in my cave? Back down to my mother, whose disapproval of the DDF might finally make me lose the rest of my nerve? I crumpled the leave ticket in my pocket and walked to our classroom, where I sat down in my seat alone. I really just wanted to think, to talk to Cobb, to sort through all of this. Hurl had said, "Brave to the end." And she had been. Scud. Pearl was gone. In Gran Gran's stories, they held feasts in honor of the fallen. But I didn't want to feast. I wanted to crawl somewhere dark and curl up. Strangely, as class time approached, the door creaked open and the others, except for Jorgen, arrived in a solemn, quiet group. Hadn't the nurse said we all had leave? Perhaps they, like me, didn't want to accept it. Kimmelin stopped by my seat and gave me a hug. I didn't want a hug, but I took it. I needed it. Even Jorgen arrived about 10 minutes after class normally began. "I thought I might find you all here," he said. I braced myself for him to tell us to go, for him to toe the official line and tell us class was canceled because we were on forced leave. Instead, he inspected us, then nodded in an approving way. "Skyward flight, line up," he said in a soft voice. He hadn't tried that since the first day, when we'd ignored him. Today, though, it felt right. We four got up and stood in a row. Jorgen walked to the classroom intercom and pushed one of the buttons. "Jax, will you send to Captain Cobb and tell him his flight is waiting for him, in their usual room? Thank you." Jorgen then walked over and joined us in line. Together, we waited. 15 after. 20 after. It was 0729 before Cobb slammed open the door and limped in. We snapped to attention and saluted. He looked at us, then roared, "Sit down!" I started. That wasn't what I had expected. Still, along with the others, I jumped to obey. "If you are in an uncontrolled descent," he shouted at us, his face coloring, "then you eject. You hear me? You scudding eject." He was angry. Like, actually angry. He pretended to be angry sometimes, but it was nothing like this. Red-faced, spitting as he shouted. "How many times did I say this?" he said. "How many times did I give you orders? And still you buy into that nonsense?" He waved his hand out the window, toward the large DDF high command building. "The only reason we have this stupid culture of self-martyrdom is because somebody feels they have to justify our casualties, to make them seem honorable, righteous. It's neither one, and you're fools for listening to them. Don't you throw your lives away. Don't you dare be like that idiot yesterday. Don't call her an idiot," I snapped. "She was trying to fly a controlled crash. She was trying to save her ship. She was scared of being called a coward," Cobb bellowed. "It had nothing to do with the ship. Pearl, Hadea, was a hero." I glared at him. "She was a—" I stood up. "Simply because you want to justify your cowardice in ejecting doesn't mean we have to do the same." Cobb froze. Then he kind of deflated. He sank down into the seat by his desk. He didn't seem wise or even grizzled, just old, tired, and sad. I immediately felt embarrassed. Cobb didn't deserve that. He hadn't done anything wrong in ejecting, and even the DDF didn't blame him. And Hurl, well, I'd told her to eject. I'd practically begged her to. But she hadn't. And we had to respect her choice, didn't we? "You're all on medical leave for a week," Cobb said. "Dr. Thior has been pushing to give more leave to flights once they lose members. And it looks like she's started to get her way." He stood up and stared right at me. "I hope you enjoy being a hero when your corpse is rotting like your friends, alone in a wasteland, forgotten and ignored." "She'll be given a pilot's burial," I said. "Her name will be sung for generations." He snorted. "If they had to sing the name of every fool cadet who died on her way to pilot, we'd never have time for anything else. And Hurl's corpse isn't going to be recovered for at least several weeks. The scouts confirmed that the crash destroyed her ship's acclivity ring beyond recovery. There's nothing on that POCO worth salvage priority, not considering that big wreck we're still working on. So your heroic friend will be left out there, another dead pilot buried by the slag of her own explosion. Scud. I have to go write a letter to her parents and explain why.
I can't trust what Ivans will say.
He hobbled toward the door, but stopped and turned toward Kimmelin. I hadn't noticed that she'd stood up. She saluted him, eyes teary. Then she dropped something on her seat. Her cadet's pin. Cobb nodded.
Keep the pin, Quirk, he told her. You're dismissed, with whatever honors matter to you.
He turned and left.
Dismissed? Dismissed? He can't do that to you, I demanded, turning toward Kimmelin. She wilted.
I asked for it after the battle. He told me to think about it overnight. And I did. But you can't.
Jorgen stepped up beside me, confronting Kimmelin. Spin is right, Quirk. You're an important member of this flight.
The weakest member, Kimmelin said. How many times has one of you had to pull out of a fight to come and save me? I'm putting you all in danger.
Contrary to what Cobb had said, she left her pin on her seat as she walked toward the door.
Kimmelin, I said, feeling helpless.
I rushed after her and took her hand.
Please. I got her killed, Spin, she whispered. You know that as well as I do.
She got herself killed.
The one shot that mattered. That's the one I missed.
There were two ships chasing her. One shot, even if it had hit, might not have been enough. She smiled, squeezed my hand, then left. I felt my world collapsing. First Hurl, now Kimmelin. I looked toward Jorgen. Surely he could stop this. Couldn't he? He stood stiffly, tall, with that too handsome face. He stared straight ahead, and I thought I could see something in his eyes. Guilt? Pain? He's watching his flight break apart around him, too. I had to do something. Make some kind of sense out of this disaster and of my pain. But no, I couldn't, wouldn't stop Kimmelin. At least she'd be safe this way.
Hurl, though.
Arturo, I said, picking up my pack. About how far out was that battle, would you say?
Pretty close to our original position, beyond the AA guns. Say, 80 clicks?
I shouldered my pack.
Great.
I'll see you all in a week.
Where are you going?
FM asked.
I'm going to find Hurl, I said,
and give her a pilot's burial. Chapter 34. I trudged across the dry, dusty ground. My compass kept me on the right heading, which was important, because everything looked the same out here on the surface. I tried not to think. Thinking was dangerous. I'd barely known Bim and Morningtide, and their deaths had left me shaken for weeks. Hurl had been my wingmate. It was more, though. She'd been like me. At least, like I pretended to be. She was usually one step ahead of me, leading the charge. In her death, I saw myself. No. No thinking. That didn't stop the emotions. The hole inside, the pain of a wound rubbed raw. After this, nothing could ever be the same. Yesterday hadn't just marked the death of a friend. It marked the death of my ability to pretend this war was, in any way, glorious. My radio was blinking. I hit the switch.
Spencer?
Embot asked.
Are you certain this journey is wise? I am not capable of worry, mind you, but
I'd rather be alone, I said. I'll call you tomorrow or something. I clicked the radio off and stuffed it inside my backpack, where I'd stashed some rat meat and water for the journey. If it wasn't enough, I could go hunting. Maybe I'd vanish into the caverns, never to return, become a nomad, like my clan before the founding of Alta, and never fly again. Just walk, Spencer, I told myself. Stop thinking and walk. This was simple. This I could do. I was about 2 hours outside Alta when a sound broke the quiet and I turned to see a hover car approaching. It flew 3 meters off the ground and towed a wake of dust behind. Had someone warned the Admiral? Had she sent MPs with some made-up reason why I couldn't be out here? No. As it got closer,
I realized I recognized that blue car. It was Jorgen's. He must have gotten the power matrix replaced. I grunted, then turned forward and kept walking. He pulled up beside me and lowered his car so that his head was barely a meter above mine.
Spin? Are you really planning to walk 80 clicks?
I didn't reply.
You realize it's dangerous out here, Jorgen said. I should order you back. What if you get caught in a debris fall?
I shrugged. I'd been living near the surface for months, and had only really been in danger that one time when I'd discovered Embot's cave.
Spensa, Jorgen said. For the North Star's sake, get in. I'll drive you.
Don't you have some fancy rich person event you need to be attending?
My parents don't know about the medical leave yet. For a little while, I'm as free as you are.
Me? Free? I wanted to laugh in his face. Still, he had a car. This would transform a multi-day trip into one that would last a few hours. I resented him for giving me the option, as I'd wanted to be on my own. To suffer, perhaps. But a part of me knew I wouldn't reach Hurl's body with what I had in my pack. I'd probably be forced to turn back after a day of hiking.
I want to go with you, Jorgen said. It's a good idea. Hurl deserves this. I brought some materials for the pyre.
Stop being right, Jorgen, I thought. But I walked around the car and climbed into the passenger side. I had dust up to my thighs, which I smeared all over the car's interior, but he didn't seem to notice. He pushed on the car's throttle, sending us darting across the landscape. The car had a small acclivity ring and no booster, just basic thrusters. But being so close to the ground, I felt like we were going faster than we really were, particularly with no roof and the wind blowing my hair. I let the motion transfix me.
Do you want to talk?
Jorgen asked. I didn't reply. I didn't have anything to say.
A good flight leader is supposed to be able to help his flight with their problems, he said. You couldn't have saved her, Spin. There's nothing you could have done.
You think she should have pulled out, I said.
That's not relevant now.
You think she shouldn't have gone for that kill. You think she disobeyed protocol and shouldn't have flown off on her own. You're thinking it.
I know you are. You're judging her. So now you're angry at me for things I might be thinking?
Were you thinking them? Were you judging her? Jorgen didn't say anything. He kept driving, wind blowing in his too neat, too perfect hair. Why do you have to be so stiff all the time? I asked. Why does your way of helping always sound like you're quoting from some manual? Are you some kind of thinking machine? Do you actually care? He winced, and I squeezed my eyes shut. I knew he cared. I'd seen him that morning in the classroom, trying to find a way to save Morningtide in the simulation, over and over. My words were stupid, thoughtless, which was exactly what I got for not thinking. Why do you put up with me? I asked. I opened my eyes and leaned my head back, staring at the debris field high overhead. Why didn't you turn me in for vandalizing your car, or assaulting you, or a dozen other things?
You saved Ned's life.
I tipped my head and looked at Jorgen. He was driving with his eyes fixed straight ahead.
You followed my friend into the belly of a beast, he continued, and you towed him by his collar to safety. Even before that, I knew. You're insubordinate, mouthy, and, well, you're scudding frustrating. But when you fly, Spin, you fly as part of a team, and you keep my people safe.
He looked at me, met my eyes.
You can swear at me all you want, threaten me, whatever. So long as you fly like you did yesterday, protecting the others, I want you on my team.
Pearl still died, I said. Kimmelin still left.
Pearl died because of her recklessness. Quark left because she felt inadequate. Those problems, like your insubordination, are my fault. It's my job to keep my flight in line.
Well, if they're handing you impossible jobs, why don't they just ask you to defeat the Krell all on your own? Seems about as likely to happen as you wrangling the lot of us. He stiffened, eyes forward, and I realized he'd taken it as an insult. Scud. We eventually passed the AA gun battery,
and Jorgen called them to prevent their proximity warnings from going off. They let him go without question once he mentioned who he was, the son of a First Citizen. After the AA guns, it was surprisingly easy to locate Hurl's wreckage. She'd skidded some 100 or more meters, gouging the dusty earth with a wide scar. The ship had broken into 3 big chunks. The rear of the fuselage, with the booster, had apparently ripped off first. As we drove along, we found where the middle of the fuselage, what was left of it, had made a large black mark on the ground. The power matrix had exploded after hitting some rocks and had destroyed the acclivity ring. That was the flash I'd seen. But a small chunk of the front fuselage, with the cockpit, had broken free and skidded on farther. My heart leaped as I spotted the bent remnants of the cockpit crushed up against a pile of large boulders ahead. Jorgen landed the hover car and I scrambled out, dashing ahead of him. I jumped onto the first of the rocks, then heaved myself up onto another, scraping my fingers. I needed to get high enough to see into the crushed cockpit. I had to know. I pulled myself up to a higher boulder where I could look down into the broken canopy. She was there. A part of me hadn't believed she would be. A part of me had hoped that Hurl had somehow pulled herself from the wreckage, that she was walking back, battered but alive, self-assured as always. That was a fantasy. Her pressure suit reported vitals, and we all had emergency transmitters to activate if we needed rescuing. If Hurl had survived, the DDF would have known. One glimpse confirmed that she'd probably died at the first impact. She was crushed, pinned inside the mangled metal of the cockpit. I tore my gaze away, cold flooding my chest. Pain, emptiness. I looked back along the scar in the ground her ship had made while crashing. That long swath seemed to indicate that she'd managed to get her ship horizontal at the end, that she'd gotten close to a gliding position. So she'd almost done it. With a blown-off wing and a broken acclivity ring, she'd still almost landed. Jorgen grunted as he tried to climb up. I gave him a hand, but sometimes I forgot how small I was compared to someone like him. He nearly pulled me right off with a casual jerk of his arm. He scrambled onto the rock beside me, then took a quick glance at Hurl. He went pale and turned aside, settling down on an upper portion of a boulder. I set my jaw, then forced myself to climb into the cockpit and pull Hurl's pin off her bloodied flight suit. The least we could do was return that to her family. I looked at Hurl's lacerated face, her one remaining eye staring ahead. Defiant until the end, for all the good it had done. Brave, cowardly. She was still dead, so what did it matter? Feeling like a terrible friend for those thoughts, I closed her eye, then climbed out and wiped my hands on my jumpsuit. Jorgen nodded toward the car. I've got the things for the pyre in the trunk. I let myself down with my light line, and he followed. In the trunk of the vehicle, we found some oil and a bundle of wood, which surprised me. I'd been expecting coal. He really was rich if he had this on hand. We climbed back to the ship, then pulled the bundle up after us with my light line. We started packing the wood into the cockpit, piece by piece. This is how our ancestors used to do it, Jorgen said as he worked. Burn the ship, out on the ocean. I nodded, wondering how little he thought of my education if he assumed I didn't know that. Neither of us had ever seen an ocean, of course. Detritus didn't have them. I poured oil onto the wood and the body, then stepped back, and Jorgen handed me the lighter. I lit a small stick, then tossed it into the canopy. The sudden intensity of the flames took me by surprise, and sweat prickled my brow. The two of us retreated farther, and eventually climbed onto one of the higher boulders. By tradition, we saluted the flames. Return to the stars, Jorgen said, the officer's part. Sail them well, warrior. It wasn't the whole elegy, but it was enough. We settled down on the rocks to watch, by tradition, until the fire went out. I rubbed Hurl's pin, bringing back the gleam. I'm not defiant, Jorgen said. What? I thought you grew up in the deep caverns. I mean, I'm defiant. I'm from the Defiant Caverns. But I don't feel defiant. I don't know how to be like you. And Hurl. Since I was little, everything has been scheduled for me. How am I supposed to follow the grand speeches? Defying the Krell, defying our doom. When everything I do has 7 rules attached to it. At least it got you flight lessons and free entry into the DDF. At least you can fly. He shrugged. 6 months. Excuse me? That's how long I get after graduation, Spin. They put me in Cobb's class because it's supposed to be the safest for cadets. And once I graduate, I'm to fly for 6 months. At that point, I'll have enough of a record as a pilot to be respected by my peers, so my family will pull me out.
They can do that?
Yeah. They'll probably make it look like a family emergency. A need for me to step into my government position sooner than anticipated. The rest of my life will be spent in meetings, interfacing on behalf of my father with the DDF.
Will you ever get to fly?
I suppose I could go up for fun. But how could it compare to flying a real starfighter in battle? How could I go out for joyrides, a few calculated and protected moments, when I've had something so much greater?
He glanced up at the sky.
My father always worried that I liked flying too much. To be honest, during my practices, before I started official training, I thought a pair of wings might let me escape his legacy. But I'm not defiant. I'll do what's expected of me.
Huh, I said softly.
What?
Nobody calls your father a coward. Yet, you do still live in his shadow. Somehow, Jorgen was trapped as soundly as I was. All his merits couldn't buy him freedom. Together we watched the embers of the pyre die as the sky grew darker, the ancient skylights dimming. We shared a few thoughts of Hurl, though we had both missed out on her nightly dinnertime antics and had only heard of them secondhand. She was like me, I finally said, as the fire grew cold and the hour late. More me than I am, these days. Jorgen didn't press me on that. He just nodded. And by this light, a few embers of the fire reflecting in his eyes, his face didn't seem quite as punchable as it always had before. Maybe because I could read the emotions behind that mask of authoritarian perfection. When the last light of the fire went out, we stood and saluted again. Jorgen then climbed down to his car, explaining he needed to check in with his family. I stood on the high rock, looking again along the gouge that Hurl's crash had caused. Did I blame her for wasting her life? Or did I respect her for refusing, at all costs, to be branded a coward? Could I feel both at once? She really did almost make it, I thought, noting the nearly undamaged wing lying nearby. And farther back, the rear end of the fuselage, ripped off, sitting on its own. Booster included. I felt a sudden spike of realization. It would be weeks before anyone came to scavenge this wreckage. And if they did wonder where the booster went, they'd probably assume it blew off in the initial destructor hit. If I could somehow get it to my cave. It wouldn't be robbing the dead, Scud. Hurl would tell me to take the booster. She'd want me to fly and fight. But how in the world would I get it all the way back? A booster would be orders of magnitude heavier than I could lift. I looked toward Jorgen, sitting in his car. Did I dare? Did I have any other choice? I had seen some chains in the trunk when we'd been unloading the wood. I climbed down from the rocks and headed toward the car, walking up right as he was turning off the radio.
No emergencies yet, he said, but we should get going.
I debated for a moment before finally asking, Jorgen, how much can this car lift?
A fair amount. Why?
Are you willing to do something that sounds a little crazy?
Like flying out and giving our own funeral to one of our friends?
More crazy, I said. But I need you to do it, and not ask too many questions. Pretend I'm insane with grief or something. He looked at me, carefully.
What is it exactly that you want to do?
Chapter 35.
You realize, Jorgen said as we flew back toward Alta, I'm starting to get very suspicious.
I looked over the side to where the booster dangled from the bottom of his hover car, connected by chains to the tow ring on the underside of the chassis. His car's small acclivity ring had been barely enough to lift the weight.
First you steal my power matrix, Jorgen said. Now this.
What are you doing? Building your own Poco?
He laughed. When I didn't join in, he looked at me. Then he put the heel of his palm to his forehead, rubbing it as understanding sank in.
You are. You're building a starfighter.
I told you not to ask too many questions.
And I never agreed. Spin. You're building a ship?
Repairing, I said. I found a wreck.
All salvage belongs to the DDF. Claiming it is the same as stealing.
Like you just helped me steal a booster? He groaned and leaned back. What did you think we were doing? I asked, amused. We spent half an hour pulling a chunk of salvage from the ground.
You told me to assume you were emotionally unstable because of Hurl's death.
I didn't expect you to believe me, I said. Look, I've done this forever without getting into trouble. Down in Igneous, I used salvage to build my own spear gun for hunting.
An entire fighter is different from a spear gun.
How are you planning to fix the thing? You don't have the expertise for that, or the time. I didn't reply. No need to get Rig into trouble.
You're insane, he said.
Admiral Ironsides won't let me fly. She's got a grudge against me because of my father. Even if I graduate, I'll spend my life grounded.
So you build your own ship? What do you think is going to happen? That you'll show up on a battlefield in the nick of time, and everyone will simply forget to ask where you got your own scudding starfighter?
I honestly didn't have a response to that. I'd shoved logic aside, figuring questions like that were bridges to be burned once I captured them.
Spin. Even assuming you could fix a crashed Poco yourself, you can't, by the way. The first time you took the thing into the air, the DDF would pick it up on scanners. If you don't identify yourself, you'll get shot down. If you do, they'll take that ship from you faster than you can say court-martial.
I'd like to see them try. Maybe I don't fly it for the DDF, I said. There are other caverns, other people.
None run their own air force. They've been able to settle down because the Krell attention is focused on us.
Some use ships for trading, I pointed out.
And you'd abandon the fight, he asked. Go run cargo.
I don't know. I sank back in my seat, trying not to sulk. He was right. He was usually right. I was starting to kind of not hate him, but he was still jerkface. He sighed.
Look, if you want to fly, maybe I can get you duty as a private pilot. A few of the families in the deep caverns maintain fighters as escorts for trading operations. You wouldn't need to repair any old salvage. You could use one of our ships. Arturo's family has a few.
I perked up. Really? That's something I could do?
Maybe.
He thought for a moment.
Well, probably not. The slots are highly contested, usually flown by retired DDF pilots, and you need a really great reputation.
Something the daughter of a coward doesn't have, and will never have, unless I can fight for the DDF. The great contradiction of my life. I would never be worth anything unless I could prove myself. But I couldn't prove myself because nobody would give me the chance. Well, I wasn't willing to give up the dream of flying MBOT. Ridiculous and ill-conceived as my plan sounded when Jorgen laid them out, MBOT was my ship. I'd find a way. We flew in silence. And that left me thinking about the booster, my mind shifting to the wreckage. Strangely, it seemed that I could still feel the flames against my skin. I'd hoped that performing the funeral would help with the pain, but I still ached. Hurl's passing left so much emptiness, so many questions. Is this going to happen every time I lose a friend in battle? I wondered. It made me want to run away and become a cargo pilot like Jorgen said. to never have to face the Krell or their destructors again. Coward. Eventually, Alta came into sight in the distance. I took Jorgen's arm and pointed a few degrees to the left toward my hidden cavern. Fly us that direction. He gave me a suffering look, but did as I'd asked. I had him stop 40 meters or so from my hull, to avoid any blowing dust revealing the part of the ground that was a hologram. He lowered the hover car to gently set the booster down. As soon as I felt it hit the surface, I attached my light line to one side of the car and prepared to lower myself to unhook the booster.
Spin, Jorgen said, stopping me. Thank you.
For?
For making me do this. It feels better to have seen her off properly.
Well, at least it had helped one of us.
I'll see you in a week, he said. My family will probably schedule every moment of my free time.
He looked at me, then got a very strange expression on his face.
This broken ship. It's got a working acclivity ring?
Yes. He'd helped me out, and he knew enough already to get me into trouble 10 times over if he wanted. He deserved honesty. Yes, it's got an acclivity ring. The whole ship is in better shape than you'd think, actually.
You fix it then,
he said.
You fix it and you fly. You find a way and you defy them. For those of us who don't have the courage.
I cocked my head, but he turned away, setting his jaw and taking the wheel in both hands. So I lowered myself down, then unhooked the booster. We were close enough that I could maneuver M-Bot over and attach it, then lower it into the cavern. I'd need the chain, though, so I only unhooked one end. I waved to Jorgen, and when he rose up, the chain slid through the tow rings underneath his car and fell beside me. He didn't ask after it. He just flew off toward Alta. And responsibility. Somehow, it was true. Somehow I was more free than he was. Which felt crazy. I pulled my radio from my backpack. Hey, guess what, M-Bot? I have a present for you.
Mushrooms?
Better.
2 mushrooms?
I smiled. Freedom. Chapter 36.
I'm not going to ask you where you got this, Rig said.
He was standing, his hands on his hips, looking at the booster, which M-Bot and I had moved to the cavern floor. See? That's why you're in engineering, I said. You're smart.
Not smart enough to stay out of this mess, he said.
I grinned. M-Bot's maintenance gear included a small mobile acclivity ring for service purposes. Dwarfed by the big one he flew with, it was a small hoop, no larger than my hands pressed together, with a rechargeable power source. Rig and I placed the maintenance ring under the booster. That, once activated, raised the hunk of metal into the air about 1 meter. Together, we pushed it into place behind M-Bot, near where it would need to be installed. So, I asked, will it fit?
I can probably make it fit,
Rig said, prodding at the booster with a wrench.
Whether I can make it work or not will depend on how damaged it is.
Please tell me you didn't rip this off a functioning DDF ship. You said you weren't going to ask. He flipped the wrench in his hand, eyeing the booster.
You had better thank me in your speech when you hit ace.
6 times.
And name your firstborn son after me.
Firstborn will be Executioner Destructorious. But you can have 2.
And bake me some killer algae biscuits or something.
Do you seriously want to eat anything I've baked?
Now that I think about it, Scud, no. But next time I bake some, you better have a compliment ready. No more, it would taste better with some rat in it.
On my honor as a pilot, I said solemnly. Rig put his hands back on his hips, then grinned widely.
We're actually going to do it, aren't we? We're going to make this old bucket fly. I'd be insulted at that.
M-Bot said through the speakers at the side of the ship,
if I were human.
Rig rolled his eyes.
Would you go keep that thing occupied? I don't want it jabbering at me while I work. I can both talk to her and bother you,
M-Bot called.
Multitasking is an essential means by which an artificial intelligence achieves more efficiency than fleshy human brains.
Rig looked at me. No insult intended, Embot added. You have very nice shoes.
We've been working on his compliments, I said.
They aren't nearly as stupid as the rest of your outfit.
He still needs practice.
Just stop him from bothering me, please, Rig said, lugging over his toolbox. Honestly, if I ever find the person who thought it was a good idea to make a machine that talked to you while you were repairing it...
I climbed up to the cockpit and latched it, pressurizing and soundproofing it. Leave him alone, Embot, I said, settling into my seat. Please.
If you wish. My processors are busy anyway, trying to devise a proper joke about the fact that Rig is installing me a new butt. My logic circuits are arguing that the expeller I use for old oil is actually a better metaphoric anus.
I really don't want to talk about your scatological functions, I said, leaning back. I stared up through the glass, but there was only blackness and dark rock.
I believe that human beings need humor during times of depression, Embot said, to lighten their grim outlook and make them forget their tragedies.
I don't want to forget my tragedies. Embot was silent. Then, in a smaller voice, somehow vulnerable, he asked,
Why do humans fear death?
I frowned toward the console, where I knew the camera was. Is that another attempt at humor?
No. I want to understand.
You offer lengthy commentary about humans, but you can't understand something as simple as fear of death?
Define it? Yes. But understand it? No.
I leaned my head back again. How did one explain mortality to a robot? You miss your memories, right? The data banks that were destroyed in your crash? So you understand loss.
I do. But I cannot miss my own existence, by definition. So why would I fear it?
Because someday you'll stop being here. You'll cease to exist, get destroyed.
I am powered down repeatedly. I was powered down for 172 years. How is it different if I'm never powered on again?
I fidgeted, playing with the control sphere's buttons. I still had 6 more days of leave, of simply sitting around, supposedly recovering, but really just prodding at that hole inside me, like a child constantly picking at a scab.
Spencer,
Embot said, pulling me back.
Should I fear death?
A good defiant doesn't, I said. So maybe you were programmed this way on purpose, and it's not really my own death that I fear. Actually, I don't fear anything. I'm not a coward.
Of course.
But losing the others has me wavering. I should be strong enough to withstand this. I knew what it would cost to become a pilot. I've trained and prepared and listened to Grandgram's stories and... I took a deep breath.
I miss my pilot,
Embot said.
I miss him because of the loss of knowledge. Without proper information, I cannot judge my future actions. My ability to interface with the world and to be efficient is lessened.
He hesitated.
I am broken and do not know how to fulfill my purpose. Is this how you feel?
Maybe. I made a fist, forcing myself to stop fidgeting.
But I'm going to beat it, Embot. It must be nice to have free will.
You have free will too. We've talked about this.
I simulate it in order to seem more palatable to humans, he said. But I do not have it. Free will is the ability to ignore your programming. Humans can ignore theirs, but I, at a fundamental level, cannot.
Humans don't have programming.
Yes, you do. You have too much of it. Conflicting programs, none of it interfacing properly, all calling different functions at the same time. Or the same function for contradictory reasons. Yet you ignore it sometimes. That is not a flaw. It is what makes you, you.
I mulled that over, but I was so anxious that I had trouble sitting still. Finally, I pushed open the canopy and climbed down, then fetched my radio and my pack. Rig was absorbed by his work, humming to himself a tune I didn't know as he stripped the broken pieces of fuselage from the booster. I stepped over. "You need any help?" I asked him. "Not at the moment. I might need you in a day or two, if I have to replace wires again." He got another section off, then poked into the hole with a screwdriver. "Good thing I got the shield igniter back together. I'm going to have my hands full with this for a while." "How'd that go, by the way?" I asked. "The schematics you drew for the shield." Rig shook his head. "It was like I worried. I took the drawings to my superiors, but when I couldn't explain what was supposed to be different about this new shield I'd designed, it didn't go anywhere. M-Bot's shield and his grav caps are beyond my ability to figure out. We need real engineers studying the ship, not an intern." We shared a look, then Rig turned back to his work. Neither of us wanted to extrapolate further on that idea, the growing truth that we really should have turned M-Bot in. I hid behind the fact that he didn't want us to, and had threatened to destroy his own systems if we did. Truth was, we were both probably committing treason by working on him in secret. Rig looked like he needed to concentrate, so I stopped bothering him. I gave Doomslug a rub on the head, to which she trilled in enjoyment. Then I climbed out of the cavern and started walking.
"Where are you going?"
M-Bot asked when I clicked the radio on. "I need something to do," I said. "Something other than just sitting there, dwelling on what I've lost."
"When I am like that, I write a new subroutine for myself."
"Humans don't work the same way," I said, radio to my head. "But something you said has me thinking. You mentioned needing proper information to judge how to act."
"Early AIs were unwieldy things," he said. "They had to be programmed to take actions based on explicit circumstances. And so each discrete decision had to include a list of instructions for each possibility. More advanced AIs are able to extrapolate. We rely on a base set of rules and programs, but adapt our choices based on similar situations we have encountered. However, in both cases, data is essential to making proper choices. Without past experiences to rely upon, we cannot guess what to do in the future." "That is more than you wanted to know, but you commanded me to leave Raj alone, so I'm finding things to say to you."
"Thank you, I guess."
"Also, human beings need someone friendly to listen to them when they're grieving. So feel free to talk to me. I will be friendly. You have nice shoes."
"Is that the only thing you notice about people?"
"I've always wanted shoes. They're the sole piece of clothing that makes any sense, assuming ideal environmental conditions. They don't play into your strange and nonsensical taboos about not letting anyone see your..."
"Is this really the only thing you can think of to comfort someone who is grieving?"
"It was number one on my list."
"Great."
"The list has 7 million entries. Do you want to hear number two?"
"Is it silence?"
"That didn't even make the list."
"Move it to number two."
"All right, Oh."
I lowered the radio, walking along my familiar path. I needed to be doing something, and they wouldn't let me fly. But maybe I could answer a question. Somewhere in the DDF headquarters was a holo recording of the Battle of Alta, and I was going to find it. Chapter 37. By the time I reached Alta Base, I had a pretty solid plan. It all revolved around the one person I knew had access to the battle replays. Cobb's office was a little thing he kept immaculately clean and sterilized of all personal effects. No pictures on the walls, no books on the shelves. Today, he sat working at his narrow desk, reading some reports and marking them with a red pencil. He glanced up as I knocked on the window, then turned back to his work. I slipped the door open.
"FM's been looking for you," he said, moving one sheet onto another stack. "I told her I didn't know where your cave was. But if you want to contact the others, tune to 1250 on your radio. That's Arturo's house band."
"Thanks." I took a deep breath,
going over my carefully planned words. Sir, I hope I don't get into trouble for this, but Jorgen and I drove out and fetched Hurl's pin. For her family. I stepped forward and set it on the desk. He called into ground support and warned them we were driving past. Cobb sighed.
Well, I guess it isn't forbidden.
He picked up the pin.
Did you clear this with salvage?
No, sir.
That means more paperwork for me, he said.
We gave her a pilot's burial, sir, I said, best we could manage. Will you tell her family for me? He tucked the pin away.
They'll like that, cadet. And I doubt even salvage will complain when I put it to them that way. But do try not to get me into any more trouble this week.
I'll try, sir, I said, searching for a good way to move on to what I really wanted. Something that wouldn't raise too much suspicion from Cobb. I wish I could use my time somehow. This much leave is kind of frustrating.
Medical leave can shoot itself into the sun, Cobb agreed. I like Thyor. She keeps pushing for things like counseling for pilots, good ideas. But she needs to understand that the last thing a bunch of grieving soldiers need is more free time.
They won't let me fly or train, but maybe... I pretended to give it some thought. Maybe I could watch old battles to learn from them?
Archive is in Building H, Cobb said, pointing. They have headsets you can use for viewing the battles. You'll need my authorization code for the door. 26407.
A dozen different arguments, which I'd prepared to nudge him toward offering this, died on my lips. That was easy. Thanks, I said, trying not to show how excited I was. I guess I'll go, do that then.
Cadets aren't supposed to use the archive. If you run into trouble, tell them I sent you to fetch something for me, then get out. I'll do the paperwork for that if I have to, scudding bureaucrats.
Cobb moved a sheet from one stack to the other.
And spin?
Sir?
Sometimes. The answers we need don't match the questions we're asking.
He looked up at me.
And sometimes. The coward makes fools of wiser men.
I met his eyes, then blushed, thinking of what I'd said to him the day before, in anger. Just because you want to justify your cowardice doesn't mean we have to do the same. I'm sorry, sir, for-
Get going. I'm not completely ready to deal with you yet.
Yes, sir. I stepped out of the office. That look in his eyes. He'd known exactly why I wanted to watch old battles. He'd seen through my subterfuge immediately. Then why had he given me the code to get in? I made my way to the proper building, used the code, and started walking through the archive shelves. Many were filled with books that had been carried with the crew of the fleet. Histories of old Earth, the writings of philosophers. Mostly ancient stuff, but there were modern writings too, manuals and histories. Pilots moved about here, their pins glittering on their blue jumpsuits. As I regarded them, I realized why Cobb might have let me do this. I was less than 2 months away from graduation. On one hand, it seemed incredible that so much time had passed. On the other, a lot had been packed into those few months. Either way, I'd soon have been given access to this place. Maybe Cobb knew I'd inevitably find the secrets, so he didn't mind letting me in now. Or was it that he feared I'd somehow be denied this privilege, even if I did graduate, so he was making certain I got the chance now? I didn't dare ask for directions. I couldn't risk someone noticing the color of my pin and asking why a cadet was in here. I poked through the musty, too quiet room until I found a wall of small metal cases with dates and battle names on the spines. They were perhaps 4 centimeters square, and I watched as a pilot took one from the wall and plugged it into a viewing machine. She leaned forward, settling her eyes into the headset to watch. This was what I wanted. Though these cases only went back 5 years. Around the corner, I found a second room. The door was closed, but the windows along the sides showed it had more cases inside. I tried Cobb's code on the door. It opened, and I slipped inside, heart thumping. Nobody else was in here.
and the short rack of metal cases counted backward all the way to the one.